You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
I believe that 2016 will be the year we achieve something really vital, fundamentally changing the UK's relationship with the EU and finally addressing the concerns of the British people about our membership.
Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron continues his efforts to preserve the UK's mere sullen indifference to the EU and prevent it from degenerating into outright hostility. My guests Isabel Hilton and Peter Fleming will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Japan agrees to export planes and trains to India and import automobiles from India. Why are the two countries becoming so friendly? France imposes weight limits for models, and they're not the ones that the fashion houses might have preferred. And the undercover special forces mission thwarted by social media. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, CEO of China Dialogue, and Peter Fleming, Professor of Business and Society at Cass Business School. Welcome both back to the show. We are going to start in Brussels, where EU panjandrums have gathered to discuss, in essence, two problems: how to keep migrants out of the EU and how to keep the UK in. And as any survey of British public opinion will confirm, the two are not unrelated. On the former front, a new EU border and coast guard force has been mooted. As for the latter, British Prime Minister has laid out his demands for reform ahead of the UK's referendum on membership. These include restrictions on state benefits for EU immigrants. Isabel, first of all, the EU border coast guard thing, is this actually doing something or creating the appearance that something is being done?
Well, there are money and apparently personnel, so at least something is being done. But the
question is, do they all get a flashy new outfit? Do we know?
They get a flashy new outfit, and they get no doubt, you know, epaulettes and things like that. Whether they get deployed to Greece, though, that seems to be a bit more in doubt. So you have what you're trying to do is shore up the external borders, because the refugees and migrants are coming in the weakest link. And if Schengen is going to survive, something has to be done. But the Greeks don't seem terribly keen on having foreign personnel deployed as their border force.
Well, just to follow that up, Isabel, one of the things the Greeks are not keen on is that one part of the proposal allows these EU border guards with their flashy new epaulettes to be dispatched without necessarily the consent of the host country. What imaginable circumstance is there that the EU would wish to send its own border guards, even if the country they're sending them to doesn't want them there?
Well, that looks pretty tricky, but I'm assuming from that they couldn't get a formal agreement or an upfront commitment from Greece on the day to say, yes, you can come. Otherwise, it would have been in the deal. You know, they wouldn't have had to put that in the deal. They're having to override a reluctant Greece. That's what you're seeing in that phraseology. How that would ever work out, what threats would have to be applied to Greece to allow this to happen, I can't imagine. But the circumstances in which it might be seen as desirable, you know, you saw over the summer, you saw a border overwhelmed and simply passing on the problem into Europe. I'm not quite sure that this is going to help very much, because in the end, what's going to happen? They're going to have some kind of triage, some kind of more effective border control, but these are people arriving by, you know, sinking boats, by all kinds of transport, and they've still got to be somewhere. You can't just let them sink.
Peter, one of the many things that Greece and to a more or less equal extent Italy are not at all happy about is they're still saying that everybody else is not doing their bit, that they are having, by dint of where they happen to be, they are having to wear the brunt of this unfairly.
Yeah, well, they are doing their bit. They're dropping bombs at the moment, as is the UK. So they're doing their bit in a particular way. You know, it's almost like a perfect economy, you know, send in the bombs, then guard the borders in this authoritarian way without getting to the root of the problem. The root of the problem is what's happening in Syria at the moment and to a lesser extent in Libya. So, you know, it seems to be a sticking plaster policy once again to deal with this very, very serious humanitarian issue. And the stigmatization, you know, of these people trying to escape a war zone like anyone rational would.
Just to follow that up, what does it tell us that the EU summit has been keener to stress what they're doing to keep people out rather than what they're doing to absorb or assimilate the people who've come in?
Well, there's been a mass assimilation process, and Germany being the most notable. But even there, you know, the goodwill is running thin, as I expect it will in many other countries. We've got the kind of the lurch to the right in public opinion around this. It's all a little bit worrying. I think what we really need to do is go back to the root cause rather than kind of draw on the stereotypical kind of arguments about the dangerous immigrant, you know, that, and we all know where that leads, to go back to the root cause and try and figure out what's to be done there. And I think that just sending in, you know, more jet fighters or whatever into Syria is just not really the answer, and it's just going to perpetuate the problem.
We should look, Isabel, at, I guess, what are more domestic considerations for the UK. David Cameron has once again reiterated he has four conditions, three of which I think are somewhat arcane distractions from the fact that he knows as well as everybody else does that the UK's referendum on EU membership is basically a referendum about immigration, isn't it?
Well, it's that, and it's a referendum about David Cameron's inability to lead his own party. You know, where we are going to have to spend 6 months, you know, in this absurd debate, when everybody knows that the people inside his party who wish the UK to leave the European Union will not be satisfied whatever he brings back from Brussels. We also know that everyone's a little fed up with Britain being a problem when there are much, much bigger problems to deal with. So the amount of flexibility that even a European Union with goodwill can offer to Britain is minimal. So he's going to have to come back and pretend that he's won something terribly serious and then try to, you know, whip up an enthusiasm for Europe, which has been notably lacking in his leadership to date. It would have been far better if he'd slapped these people down at the beginning. You know, Bill Cash has been trying to get Britain out of Europe for 30 years. Whatever anybody says, he's not going to change his position. It's a ridiculous, time-wasting and embarrassing charade.
He's stressing, Peter, this is the key reform he wants to bring back, is restricting state benefits to incoming migrants. At the risk of allying myself with Bill Cash et al., is there actually anything wrong with that? Because I arrived here initially on a visa which restricted my access to state benefits, as long as I sort of paid my own way, paid my taxes and generally behaved like a solid citizen. I remember thinking at the time that was pretty well fair enough.
Well, the arguments for and against seem to kind of ebb and flow with the demand for labour in the UK at the moment.
Indeed,
the demand.
So
you know, and the kind of, again, the stereotype that everyone coming from Poland immediately signs up for unemployment benefits is just falsely wrong. I completely agree with Isabel here that, you know, Cameron's fighting this argument that he doesn't really even believe in. So he's really painted himself into a corner here. And, you know, really to win as part and parcel of the election strategy, he tried to steal votes from the far right, Farage, basically, and kind of agreed to this ludicrous idea of a referendum. And now you can see him, you know, he's kind of in this very, very difficult position. But when it comes to repealing, you know, human rights laws at the European Court, that's very, very serious. And I think, you know, there is a reason why the other states are very worried about that, because that sets a precedent for really, really kind of nasty things to happen afterwards.
Okay, well, as you've both intimated, we are looking at the very least at the thick end of another year of this before the earliest possible vote, so that's plenty of time to come back to it. We shall move on. Earlier this week on Midori House, we were discussing the most eye-catching upshot of Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's recent visit to India, which was the sale of one of Japan's bullet trains to India, which will cut the 8-hour lumber between Mumbai and Ahmedabad to a 2-hour commute. Less picturesque, but arguably more important agreements were reached, however, including on nuclear energy, and defence. Isabel, those of us with memories stretching all the way back to the late 90s can remember Japan imposing sanctions and suspending aid to India over nuclear testing. What's changed?
Ooh, lots of things have changed. The United States finally led the charge in forgiving India for being so discourteous as to test a weapon, and began this process of re-including India into a civil nuclear programme. The other thing, of course, that's changed is you know, tensions in Asia over the rise of China and the continuing strategic rivalry between the US and China, over things like, you know, their development plan for the region. So it's TPP versus One Belt, One Road, or TPP versus OBOR, if you're really, you know, keen on this kind of thing. There are the military nudgings, you know, they're selling, well, part of this agreement is selling military hardware, and India taking part in joint military exercises with the US and Japan. You know, China sees this as further containment of China, no doubt with some justice. But it's been interesting to see that India, which has played a fairly balanced game up till now, you know, with this visit and with this new strategic relationship with Japan, is, I think, inclining in the US-Japan direction without entirely falling over. I have to say, I rather welcome the bullet train. I was once on a train that was 3 days late in India, so anything that improves the service is welcome.
We were saying the other day that the people riding on top will need to hang onto their hats. But yes, I mean, the Indian railway network is, I mean, it is one of the world's great extraordinary logistical marvels, but it's not the quickest. It has to be said. Peter, Shinzo Abe seems to be feeling his way here on a couple of things. He is trying to reform Japan's view of its own defense force, both, I guess, culturally and constitutionally. India will be the first major purchaser of Japanese military hardware. There will be Shinmeiwa US-2 amphibious aircraft. Is that, which are air sea rescue aircraft, is that a deliberately benign choice, do you think?
It probably is. It probably is. And also, you know, the United States is, and among other major powers, are still slightly worried about this resurgence in Japanese kind of military might that had been lying dormant for many, many years for obvious reasons. So I guess the nondescript element of this deal is quite intentional. But I guess also India has to play its cards right, because it doesn't necessarily want to shut out China from its economic and trade relationships. And so it could be going down a blind path slightly here.
Isabel, I did want to return to the question of cooperation over nuclear energy. India is still observing a moratorium on weapons testing. But again, in terms from Shinzo Abe's point of view, in terms of trying to get the Japanese public to go places it hasn't quite gone since the end of World War II, this is obviously, I mean, the resonances don't need spelling out where Japan's concerned, not just in terms of World War II, but of their unfortunate, you know, mishaps recently with Fukushima and the tsunami. How comfortable are the Japanese electorate going to be about this?
I think, well, the Japanese electorate is pretty divided. You know, most people of any voting age in Japan have grown up in post-war Japan with a pacifist constitution. On the other hand, they are now face-to-face with a hostile and very resurgent China, you know, the East China Sea as well as the South China Sea. Japan is at the end of some very long, thin supply lines. And although you might think the South China Sea wasn't a huge issue for Japan, it is, because 80% of Japan's fuel comes through the South China Sea. So there is, I think, there is public disquiet in Japan about the relationship with China and the hostility, the fact that for the Chinese public, you know, that is a public that's been educated to see Japan as the principal enemy, all the unresolved historical questions and so on. If you want to have a nationalist resurgence or a moment of high nationalism in China, you pick on Japan. It's really very easy. So I think mixed feelings in Japan. And as far as the civil nuclear power goes, you know, that's been a long-standing collaboration with the United States. Fukushima is very unfortunate, for sure, and certainly has left some bad memories in Japan. But I don't think that they will find it unhelpful to be building nuclear power in India, particularly when India's alternative is to build an awful lot of new coal.
Peter, as Isabel was saying, Japan has also become now a permanent addition to the Malabar naval exercises between the United States and India. What does that tell us about the way that the relationship between Tokyo and New Delhi is developing? Is it just that they both have concerns about China, or do they have more in common than that?
I would say that from what I gather, it is a geopolitical move. The antipathy between Japan and China goes back a long time, and you know, Japan's continuously coming out and apologising for its past misdeeds, unlike many other countries in the area. So I think that there is a kind of a Cold War moment here with in relation to China and the US relations, which have been very, very cool. So, you know, but having said that, and having, you know, going back to our original point, having travelled on a train in India myself, you know, the only thing I can kind of compare it to is the train from Liverpool Street here in London to my home community in Stoke Newington. That's roughly about the same.
It can't have been that bad.
No.
Maybe you could get Japan involved in that.
Exactly, yeah.
I did want to return, before we move on, Isabel, to the question of the defence purchase, or the quite small one, at least at this stage, of the US two seaplanes. How much does that change the balance of power in Southeast Asia, the idea that Japan is now an exporter of what I'm sure is extremely good military hardware?
Well, it depends how much people buy, really. I don't think that anyone envisages any power in the region in a military conflict with China, honestly, without US backing. So this is a signal rather than it doesn't change any military balance to speak of. I think avoiding war is certainly India's concern, but being seen to be robust is also India's concern. And, you know, it's not China and the South China Sea and the Indian, those are not the only worries that India has. You know, China is now brokering peace agreements or trying to broker peace agreements in Afghanistan, a country that India has a big stake in. China's closest ally in the region is Pakistan, as we know. So China's support for Pakistan has been a continuing concern for India. So it is a pretty complicated chess game. And the purchase of military equipment from Japan is, I think, symbolic rather than game-changing. But symbolism matters in this game.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Isabel Hilton and Peter Fleming. Coming up next, France's efforts to police its catwalks and the American commandos whose mission was so secret, even they didn't appear to know what it was.
We're raising the curtain on a brand new show here on Monocle 24, devoted to the best in cinema. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics, and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to Hollywood's golden age and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
Hear feature-length interviews with the biggest names, roundtable discussions, special reports, and more as Monocle 24 delves into the rich history of the silver screen. The cinema show on Monocle 24, in association with Mubi, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, because life is too short for bad films.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Isabel Hilton and Peter Fleming. Now, the observation that fashion promotes an unrealistic and arguably unhealthy body image, especially of and to women, is not an original one. A few countries, among them Italy, Spain and Israel, have even gone so far as to pass laws against underweight models. France now looks set to join them. Permission to tread the catwalks of Paris will now be contingent on a doctor's certificate of good health, and photographs which have been digitally fiddled will have to be labelled as such. Isabel, someone round the table has to be the head-banging libertarian crank, so I'll have a crack at it. Is this just not assuming that people can't make their own sane, rational judgments about what examples they should emulate?
Well, you have to assume in that 16-year-old girls are sane, rational and making mature judgments, and we perhaps can't entirely rely on that. So, look, the promotion of glamorous images and body images is a very powerful one. You know, that's what you see these images reflected back everywhere. And if you are an uncertain adolescent of as all of us have been, you know, perhaps not the perfect body shape, it certainly, I think, has a strong influence. Whether this is going to fix it, I don't know. But I think that every other method has been tried. We've tried persuasion, we've tried shaming Vogue, we've tried all kinds of things, but it doesn't really work.
Peter, isn't the entire point of models that they don't look like the rest of us?
Well, that's certainly true. When I lived in Shoreditch for 3 or 4 years, it was a major model shoot, and I'd walk outside of my house and I'd be shocked. They'd almost look alien-like, you know, quite amazing, really. But I did want to go down to the local burger shop and get them some food, you know, because they did look sick. You know, there's a reason they call it heroin chic. It's because to get the look, you actually have to be kind of on a addicted to a drug in which you don't eat for weeks on end. So there is an entertainment element to it, a fantasy element to it, but we're learning more and more that actually does have an impact on the way in which real people live their lives, with anorexia endemic in France and many other countries, including the UK. You know, I think we should welcome such a initiative.
If you look back to models of the 1950s, late 50s, early 60s, you'd be staggered how big they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, we really, this is a trend that has been accelerating over the last 40 years. And I think in the 50s, certainly people found those images glamorous. So we've been conditioned to think that only heroin chic is glamorous these days. And that's just unhealthy.
It's also arguable, I guess, that it is accelerated by the fact that more and more people, especially younger people, spend more and more time absorbed in altered versions of reality on screens of one sort or another. But just to follow that up, Isabel, doesn't anybody in any kind of public sphere at all alter their image, though, to maximise whatever advantages they have?
Yes, but I guess it depends what they're starting from. I mean, if you're a male politician, you know, you may alter your image and you know, you may clean yourself up and make sure you get a haircut, but that doesn't really impact on adolescent boys' perceptions, does it? I think it's about the objectification of women, which is far greater than the objectification of men.
True.
And the fact that adolescent girls are prisoners of the sense that they are judged on their appearance far more than boys are, or indeed
also
adults.
True. Peter, does legislating, though, actually make a difference, do you think?
Well, it will in this case, because the magazines will be quite seriously fined, I gather.
Well, my point being, though, that in this day and age, if what you really want to do is look at pictures of extremely scrawny or digitally altered people, the fact that you can't do it in a French magazine isn't going to stop you.
Well, I guess it's all part of the puzzle, isn't it? You know, there's going to be many kind of elements to it, and there's going to be ideal body type norms coming from various parts of the media and from, you know, peers, et cetera, et cetera. But I think this is a big part of the puzzle. And, you know, there is a reason that anorexia is a modern problem. There is a reason that it kind of coincides with the rise of this kind of unrealistic imaging of women's bodies. So, and increasingly men's bodies as well. You know, it's a new phenomenon of anorexia and neurosis among men. So, you know, I don't think it's the only reason behind it, but it's certainly a big part of it.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we are going to turn to, it's one of the week's more amusing stories. It does seem a reasonable assumption that one of the very first lessons taught in the special operations schools of modern militaries is the one about not getting your faces plastered all over social media minutes into your deployment. A contingent of US commandos would appear to have fallen at this very low and early hurdle. A snap of the plainclothes troops appearing on the Facebook page of the Libyan Air Force very shortly after their disembarkation location at the country's Wateer airbase. Isabel, the serious question that this prompts to me is the age of covert warfare actually coming to an end?
This is completely mind-boggling. It does remind me of the Argentinian secret police who used to go around in cars with Policia Secreta painted on the outside, you know. And they were nevertheless a force to be reckoned with. What puzzles me about this story is that, you know, trying to decipher, and I have to say my Arabic is perhaps not up to the task, why those pictures appeared on the Libyan... I mean, who knew the Libyan Air Force had a Facebook page, for a start?
You know, well, we all do now.
All kinds of learning here.
Their follower count, I'm sure, has rocketed in the last few days.
Absolutely.
No pun intended.
But it is they who posted these pictures, and the accompanying comments seem to be of the nature of, you know, what were these guys doing here? Nobody told us they were coming.
Well, that does appear to be the thing, and this is I am something of an aficionado of the old school military balls up, and this does appear to have all the hallmarks. The Pentagon's extremely odd statement was, with the concurrence of Libyan officials, U.S. military personnel traveled to Libya on 14th of December to engage in a dialogue with representatives of the Libyan National Army. While in Libya, members of a local militia demanded that the U.S. personnel depart. In an effort to avoid conflict, they did leave without incident. Peter, as far as it's possible to tell, what on earth has gone on here?
Well, I'm not too sure. It is all a bit bizarre, but I love the version of kind of blending in with the local peoples in Libya. You know, they look like they're out on a hunting trip in the forests of California, which I'm not, you know, off a John Candy Uncle Buck movie.
I haven't been to Libya for a long time, but when I was there about 10 years ago, it would not have struck me that the way to blend in was wear a sort of lumberjack shirt and a hipster beard and an American issue rifle.
All I needed was a fishing rod. Maybe that would have been the thing.
It is extraordinary. I do like the euphemism, in an effort to avoid conflict, they left without incident. That is a great new way of saying they ran away. But is it, again, to return to the original question, Isabel, is it even possible, do you think, to plan missions anymore? I mean, it reminds me a bit of, do you remember the engineer in Abbottabad in Pakistan who ended up inadvertently live-tweeting the Osama bin Laden raid? Is it possible to plan anything anymore without at least considering the possibility that the whole thing's going to end up on Instagram within, you know, within 10 seconds of the first shot being fired?
Well, clearly that is an ever-present danger, but the secrecy of this operation seems to, you know, the purpose of it seems to have been a secret from the people involved as well, and the Libyan hosts. So you can't say they didn't try to keep a secret. They just maybe were concentrating on the wrong things. And perhaps, you know, the old, you know, staining one's face with nut juice and slipping unnoticed into the local bazaar, which is what spies allegedly used to do, might be trotted out again as an option. But these guys were so conspicuous, as you say, that there are no secret to be kept.
I mean, they would, of course, be far from the first personnel in the history of warfare to have arrived at a deployment without the faintest idea of where they were or what they were doing or why they were there. But Peter, the same point to you, is this something that militaries have not yet caught up with? Technology does have a way of outrunning officialdom. Is there really anything that, I mean, when you think of sort of the legendary special ops raids, you know, of the past, say, could you mount Entebbe now without it leaking or without somebody at the airport saying, gosh, look what's happening?
It would be very, very difficult, you know, and there are a lot of military kind of hiccups along this line with the Obama thing, all sorts of things. But, you know, I think that it's also part of the kind of expectation that in Libya or in Syria, they don't have mobile technology. Facebook hasn't reached there yet. It's kind of an imperialist sort of mindset that
we saw that a lot in the migrant story as well, this sort of outrage that these people have mobile phones.
Yeah. So why are they running? You know, so... I think that's probably, you know, there's a backstory that we probably don't know about. They probably were just lost, to be honest. and they were looking for help. That's probably my guess.
Small groups of armed men in empty spaces, you know, they do tend to get picked up. You remember those British special forces, it was the SAS or the SBS, who got picked up in Argentina during the Falklands War, having, I think, come across from Chile, aiming at one of those military ports in military airports in southern Argentina, where there's not much to hide in.
Indeed not. I'm also reminded of the British troops who went ashore on the wrong beach on an exercise near Gibraltar and ended up temporarily invading Spain. One of the soldiers involved said it was down to the most dangerous creature on earth, an officer with a map. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Isabel Hilton and Peter Fleming, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. For the next half hour, Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be keeping you company with our international playlist. The menu follows at 1900, the Monocle Daily at 2200. For this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.